Welcome to the School of the Wolf podcast. I'm Hannah. This is Kieran.
Hello.
That's my favourite thing you've ever done ever. We wanted to do this podcast because we haven't done a podcast before and we like to talk shit about the stuff we love. That's a pretty accurate description, right? That's
basically it, yeah. Originally it was going to be on Aragorn, wasn't it?
And it was, yes.
You're just like, this is a really, really dull book.
I mean, the upside is that a new book has just come out, but trying to find some nice things to write about Aragorn was really hard.
Yeah.
And I loved Aragorn when I first read it. The film was absolute horseshit, but I loved the books.
Yeah.
And rereading them, I was falling quickly out of love with them. So I put them down. They will never be picked up again. So now I'm going to talk shit about something that I know nothing about and therefore have no emotional attachments to.
That I have an emotional attachment to instead.
Exactly.
I really enjoy it. She's going to rip the shit out of it. And I'll just be like, what? Actually,
yeah.
You're wrong.
We'll see. So essentially, I read a lot of fantasy. I write a lot of fantasy. Humble brag, got 2 degrees. One in English with creative writing and the other in just creative writing and novel writing. So I have written a book. I'm currently querying and self-publishing a book. And I'm a fucking fantasy nerd. So there's not a lot I don't know about fantasy, but from a real kind of like theory, story writing perspective.
All the different tropes,
different styles of character, settings, plot structure. These are all things that I have a real passion about, and will get really nerdy about. Whereas for you, it's a completely different tack.
Yeah, I'm not big on reading. I much prefer like a visualization of storytelling, usually through video games. I absolutely love them, but not just playing them. Like, I make my own, which is fun. So it's fun to try and work out that storytelling in that medium a lot more than just words on a page for me.
Yeah, fair enough.
Personally. I have played through the Witcher games.
And you've read the stories as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've read the first book and I'm kind of partway through the second book. Mm-hmm. I'm planning on just going through all the books because I really enjoy them.
Yeah. See, I don't hate them. So if at any point I say I hate them, you have to call me on that because I'm really bad for sweeping generalisations of loving and hating things.
Yep.
I don't hate the books. I think they're a really, really clever premise and I like the adaptations of different stories from like Grimm's Tales that we've heard of before. And I like the idea that he is a morally good person in a morally grey world and that corrupts choices that he does or doesn't have. But that is going from 2.5 stories, I think, we've listened to now. So I am by no means an expert in The Witcher, which is why you've come to school me, hence the School of the Wolf. We've got hot chocolates. Kieran's got his slippers on, and I've got my slipper socks on, because we live here. This is our home.
Woo!
That's my favourite bit of that.
Oh, I've got cramp. Oh, that's unfortunate. This is how I die.
That was amazing.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so before you injure yourself again, shall we start talking about the first episodes of Netflix of The Witcher?
Yeah. We didn't really explain that bit, is that we're talking mainly about the Netflix series.
Yeah.
And how it differs from the books in any
way. Yeah, how it differs from the books, the games, and whether... From my perspective, how does it show fantasy? Because fantasy has a really bad rap when it comes to like films and TV. People either adore it and it becomes a cult following, like Lord of the Rings, or it's hot garbage.
Like the last season of Game of Thrones.
Like Aragorn. And yeah, exactly. And I think this is the thing, is it's so, there's so much that you can do in fantasy that it's really, really hard to find that balance. And often... fantasy films have just elements of urban fantasy or magic realism as opposed to fully committing to it, because those that do fully commit to it either make billions or they sink, and there's no kind of like in between. So fantasy books do a lot better than fantasy films and shit like that.
Yeah.
So the fact that we actually get a fantasy series to talk about that isn't my favourite book series turned into what was my favourite TV series that then... That's the best representation of that. So yeah, so we get to talk about that. I'm really excited. So
went down quicker than Viserion.
Too soon, Kieran.
Yeah.
No, it isn't.
That's fair enough. So you really liked the opening scene. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah. So it's kind of panning in to kind of a dead setting, with the only life being a small deer drinking from the lake or river or whatever.
Swamp. Because he does say that later, that he walks through the swamps rather than the main roads. And he says because it makes him more money that way. Which I think is actually quite interesting response to it.
So it's all still. And you see like bubbles kind of coming up from the water. And you assume it's like, oh no, something's going to kill the deer. And then a monster explodes out of the water with kind of Geralt hanging off of it, hero hanging off of it, fighting it already, which I personally quite enjoyed as subverting the trope.
Yeah.
In the sense that you don't see him hunting the monster, you don't see him picking up the bounty for it. It's just done.
Yeah, we're amidst it.
Yeah.
So I think what's interesting about that, and again, this is why it's interesting that we have the two different views on it, because as a storyteller, you are always advised to throw your characters out of the airplane first and then explain why they're there. And that's exactly what this does. He is amidst the battle with this monster. We know the monster is physically stronger than he is. He is able to hold him under the water. He's throwing him around. But we still see him defeat him. And we see him defeat him using the monster's strength against him. And then it's only when he's talking to the townsfolk that we realise why he's there in the first place.
Yeah.
So he's thrown out of the aeroplane, then it's explained why he's in the aeroplane in the first place. But obviously he's thrown at a monster, and then you're explained why. So I did quite like that. I like the fact that it's literally exploding out of the water.
Yeah.
What I really liked is the only sound we hear is of the water.
Oh.
There's no other animals, there's no like bird song, there's no crickets or anything. It is just the water. There's no dramatic music, and that creates this like really great tense opening.
Yeah.
The colouring is really clever because it's all grey. And like I said earlier, the whole story is morally grey. Mm. So that kind of, the opening shot tells us exactly what this TV series is going to be about. Morally grey situations where a guy with white hair and black eyes is going to come in and try and save the day. But inevitably, he's not perfect. Something I thought was really interesting is the fact that he kills the deer. So it pans back round, the deer is lying on the floor. It's still alive, but it has a massive cut in its leg.
Yeah.
And it's at this point that the first piece of dialogue we hear is, "Today is not your day." Mm. And he says it to the deer, but we can't see the deer at this point. He walks off screen and you hear the sword kind of slicing through the deer. And it's that he's a survivalist. I described him as a bastard, but you're right. He's a survivalist. He's doing it because if he doesn't, he won't eat. My issue then comes, which you said is, we'll get to what you said earlier. The problem is we've recorded this already. We recorded 20 minutes and then realised we hadn't recorded 20 minutes. So if I say you've said already, it's because I'm trying to...
because we're remembering what we said when we did this the first time round.
Yeah, when it was a bit more authentic. Okay. So he goes into a tavern and he's offered something to eat and he says...
I'm full.
Yeah.
I had venison. Yeah, it's like, I'm full. I ate venison. Which I said previously was it's an in-joke for him. It's quite clear he's been doing this a while.
He's on his own.
He's on his own. Like, he has to entertain himself. So for the rare time that someone speaks to him and they're not spitting in his face, he's going to amuse himself. Mm. Either by making quippy comments at them or about them or whatever, which happens quite a bit in the book. Or he'll just make jokes to himself. Like little callbacks to his own jokes earlier, which is quite interesting and amusing.
Yeah, but my issue with that, whilst I like the line and I like the setting of it, you don't need both. Mm. And it felt really heavy-handed that you had the slice and then less than a minute later you have this witty line. I appreciate they are for two different reasons, but because it's not like there's some really dramatic opening credits that kind of separate it. It's not like there's another scene in between. It literally goes from him killing the monster to him walking into town.
I think it does work, though, in the sense that it's attempting to be more realistic dialogue. Like, most people, when you refuse food early in the morning, especially in a world like that where food is not you do get impoverished, like parts of town, not really, as you know, you do get impoverished parts of towns, people that can't afford to eat constantly. Mm. If someone offers you food and you go, no, I'm all right, it's usually good to give a reason. Otherwise, they may think you're a bit weird, or maybe you're ill, or whatever.
Yeah, they're going to be more skeptical. It's just not like, suspicious of you.
Yeah, it's like, no, I've already eaten.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as him going, I'm full stop. Like, he doesn't, obviously, yeah, he doesn't need to say, I had venison. But it's the same, it's just an extension of going, no, I'm good.
Yeah, but you still don't eat both, in my opinion.
No, that's fair, like, that's fair.
Yeah.
Here's why you're wrong.
Is that going to be your go-to phrase, here's why you're wrong?
Yeah.
So he rides in and enters a tavern. Now, one of the few stories that I am familiar with is the first one, which is Voice of Reason.
Yeah.
And in The Last Wish. And that's how it starts. He rides into town, he walks into a tavern, and he asks to meet...
Sorry. I cut you off.
Yeah, you did. Cheers. He rides in and asks to meet someone. The townsfolk tell him basically to get Shelton, just go. They then threaten him with physical violence. But in this version, rather than him killing them, which is what happens in the book, or what I assumed happened in the book, it's actually he's interrupted by someone else. Yeah. Now, you then told me that actually at this point is when you realised it was a different story.
Yeah.
Because I just assumed, because that's the first story in the book, just assumed that's...
To be fair, going into it, yeah, I assumed it would be the same thing. They'd either do it episodic like the first book, or start... somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I think it's the main trip up is in the Lesser Evil chapter, which is the title of the chapter that they're taking from. He doesn't come in his big long cloak, whereas he does at the start of Voice of Reason. Is they make a good point of, or they make a point of stating, it's a hot day, but he's in a big long cut, like black coat, to draw attention almost. Which I think is possibly like purposeful to trip up the readers, just to be like, this is not exactly the books, kind of get over it.
Yeah.
Or it may just be that they want to show that he likes going around in a big long cloak.
Well, then a couple of people point out that yeah, it's a big long cloak, but it's tatty and grey, so he should buy himself some new clothes.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Yeah, two or three people are just like, buy some new clothes. Maybe buy some clothes.
Yeah, but ironically, the clothes that he has underneath that cloak are pristine.
Because
when he talks to the wizard, it's pristine.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. Okay, so he enters... so there's a subversion... Like, for me, it seemed like there's a subversion because there's no fighting.
Mm.
And I think it was quite interesting that they went with that story because we've already had a fight scene. So we already... From that opening two scenes, we've established that he is a strong fighter slash killer. He will fight to kill. He's got no problem with that. That he is cunning, that he is able to use magic, because that's something we haven't talked about from the opening scene, is when his eyes go black and shows that he has these magical abilities and that he's able to use magic on these monsters.
Yeah.
So that I thought was really, really interesting. And it really stands out because of everything being black, white and grey.
Yeah.
Because there's no real contrasting colours, he looks even more demonic.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, really cool. You made a point earlier today about the colour of his eyes and what they should have been because of what they are in the books. Versus...
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously when he's had the potion or whatever it is that's caused his eyes to go black, they're quite, like, they've also got veins, which I think is a really cool effect. But yeah, in the books and the games, his eyes are described as serpent. So, like, they are that slit that he can then dilate the pupils however he likes. Whereas this one, it's just kind of a yellow iris that he's got instead.
Yeah, kind of golden. So you know he's magical, but it's not as obvious.
Yeah, like it makes sense from a filming it point of view. In Good Omens, David Tennant's character, Crawley, has those like snake slit eyes.
Yeah.
And it does look really cool, but... To have it where it's just the iris size, you wouldn't notice. Like, it's too small. His ones have to go over his entire eye or whatever. I think it makes sense that it's just a little yellow. It's easier to put in and replace if they need to. I think, yeah, they made the right choice not having it as a serpent slit in terms of ease of use over what needs to happen.
which I think makes sense in my opinion.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so yeah, rides into town, and then we have this version of that story. He is saved by a lady, sort of.
Mm.
The guys that looking to fight him are her men, and she kind of just sends them away and tells them to shut up. We then discover that she's not really a lady. And this is one of your favourite bits. This is the bit that you laughed out loud to. Because she orders beers for her and Geralt. And she basically downs her beer. Mm. And then Geralt just looks at her like, oh, that's how we're drinking today, is it?
Nice.
Yeah. And then she orders two more beers. Now, I thought it was quite interesting because the barman then treats her kind of like a drunk. He just brings her a whole pitcher over and just kind of like slams it in front of her.
Yeah.
And then she looks remorseful, which I think is quite interesting because I think she doesn't like that behaviour in herself.
I think I don't know. I think it's more I've lost a plaything now. By putting down the massive jug, it's like, cool, serve yourself, leave me alone. Instead of being like, he's still at her beck and call whenever. Like, now she doesn't have to be like, bring us two more beers. It's just, she'll pour some more.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I didn't see it as that. Mainly because he didn't want to pour beer for Geralt in the first place.
Yeah, so he brings it over. Serve Geralt at all.
Yeah. And I don't know. I just didn't see. She looks remorseful. So because her storyline is about monsters and monstrous behaviour, I thought that was quite an interesting opening for her. I really liked her as a character, and I thought as an interesting kind of opening bit, one of her bits of dialogue is, the more and more I find monsters wherever I go.
Mm.
And she says that shortly after she's given this picture. And you're not sure what monster she is talking about, but it feels like she's talking about the barman and the other men and the other racists that don't like Geralt because he's a Rivian. So
it's more he's a mutant.
Yeah,
than a Rivian, yeah. But yeah.
But yeah, the fact they've got like this issue with him. So yes, I thought that was really interesting. The next character we meet is the precocious alderman's daughter. What did you think of her?
I found her a good depiction of small children.
In what way?
She would not stop asking questions, but also when she got given a small answer, like I quite like the fact that she showed genuine intelligence.
Mm.
Because she goes through, she's asking Geralt if he's killed all of these different kinds of monsters, and then she names one that isn't real, and for the whole time he's just quiet about it. He doesn't say yes at all, and then she's like, have you killed a she-wolf? It's like, they're not real. So you have killed the others.
Yeah.
Like, it's the intelligence of, I got a reaction from that one, the other ones are true.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I quite like that.
What I thought was quite interesting is she's basically exposition lady. Like, that's her superpower. Because she comes in and she asks the right questions and she tells the right information about the town.
Yeah.
And she kind of gives, like, a background of herself and how the society works and how the world works. So anyone who is completely unfamiliar with the Witcher, by the end of that scene, you get it. Like, oh, okay, so monsters are real. People are paid to kill them. No one really likes them. Some monsters have their uses, some monsters don't. And there's this weird dichotomy between the fact that she is a really interesting character in the way that she delivers those lines, but fundamentally it's a case of, okay, those tropes that you know you're going to see, here they are on a checklist. Be prepared to see monsters, wizards, gold passing hands, bad people, like, it's all that kind of stuff. And yeah, you're right, she, like, it is clever the way she does it, but I could not help but feel a bit like, oh, cool, I'm just having the storyline handed to me little bit.
Like I said earlier, with the, like, the exposition, it's done naturally. Like, it's a child asking questions, and yeah, if you know the tropes, you notice that. If you go into it without the knowledge of tropes, it's an annoying child asking lots of questions.
I guess it was just the same as the venison thing for me. It just felt heavy-handed. I think the reason it felt heavy-handed is because the exposition of Geralt is so seamlessly done.
Mm.
Because he's fighting,
yeah.
I feel like we didn't need it. We just didn't need to know that he's killed other monsters. We get it. He's come in, he's brought this monster to, like, he wants his reward, he wants his gold, like, he didn't even check to see if it was the right monster first. He just killed a monster.
Yeah.
And then was like, oh, well, this monster was terrorising the road, so, or the swamp or whatever, so I brought it
to you. Yeah, I did like the fact that it was like, well, it was terrorising the swamp. I was like, no, we actually kind of like that one for population control.
Yeah.
Like, and I enjoy the fact they don't state if that's population control of people or wildlife.
Just in general
population control.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I really don't like my neighbour. Hey, can you go get this specific thing from the swamp for me, please?
Could you imagine if someone sends you to the swamp, you're like, oh, I thought we got on really well, but all right. You'd be sending me to the swamp all the time.
All the time.
All the time. So, the next introduction we get then is of the princess. How do you pronounce her name?
Cirilla.
Cirilla. So, you don't get her name until, like, the second to last scene.
Well, yeah, that was what I said about, like, the exposition being fluid or natural, is that it would have been so easy for her grandfather or grandmother to be like, oh, Cirilla, sit down and shut up, stop being a dick.
Yeah, yeah.
But no one does that in real life. But then the way that it is introduced is that she stumbles upon, like, a woman praying, and she says, I can't remember exactly what it is she says, but it feels natural for her to...
Yeah, she just calls her Princess Cirilla. Yeah. Because it's out of surprise.
Yeah, it's like, forgive me, Princess Cirilla. Like, she's, you've caught me. And it's like, yeah. It is...
Because she's embarrassed.
Yeah, and it's a formal thing to do to royalty, is to state their name as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's very informal to be like, oh, princess, like...
Yeah.
Just cash.
Yeah, that happens in Star Wars.
Yeah. No reward is worth this. But, like, yeah, it's... It makes sense for her name to be said there.
Hmm.
Like, instead... And I do...
Instead of where first meet
her. Yeah. Right. It would have been also very easy for the guards to come and pick her up.
Like, Princess Cirilla!
Like, you are required! And it's just... They just go, your request... Or you're, like, you're required, or whatever it is. Yeah,
You've been requested, or whatever it is. What I think is really interesting is that guy there is the same guy that is obviously with her at the end.
Mm.
He is obviously... her bodyguard.
Yeah.
And he obviously knows exactly where she is. So when we first meet the princess, she's not dressed as a princess, she's dressed as like a beggar's boy, and she's playing knuckles with the other beggar boys that have stolen a loaf of bread. And she doesn't need to eat that slice of bread, like,
yeah.
She doesn't need to win, but she's learning about her people, and she's learning, and she's escaping. So we already see that she's rebellious, but she's not rebellious to the point where actually she won't go, or she runs when she...
Yeah, like, she'll do what she needs to do as a princess, but she'll also live her life.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought that was quite interesting. Mm. And then it cuts back to Geralt, and we hear about the Curse of the Black Sun. So did you want to explain what the Curse of the Black Sun is?
It was an eclipse that when girls were born under the eclipse... All of the wizards and things like that seem to think that this caused a mutation and made them evil and essentially killed them, locked them in towers and did experiments on them and just, like, did autopsies and supposedly found these mutations.
But there's no evidence of that whatsoever.
Yeah, like, it's never... And it was the woman that was in the tavern was believed, like, was delivered by the dickhead wizard.
As he shall henceforth be called.
Yeah. Was delivered by them, by this wizard, and he's just like, yeah, she was definitely evil because she was seen, like, cutting the heads off of crows and, like, general psychopath things.
Mm. The canary, she killed the canary.
Yeah, something like that. And it was just, it was genuinely, like, horrible things for a child to do, but that's not a mutation.
No. And also, the interesting thing about it is, by this point, he's already started watching her, experimenting on her, getting her to do certain stuff. So it's like, how much of this is actually learned behaviour?
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, because they expect her to be a monster, that she becomes a monster. Yeah. Now, we as an audience don't find out that it's the woman in the tavern at this point. We just know that it's Renfrey, I think her name is. So we just know that it's this person. It's at this point that Geralt puts two and two together.
Yeah.
Which is another thing I quite
like, is that he doesn't then explain necessarily, like, his working out constantly. It's just, oh, okay, so that's what this is. Why don't you just, you know, come to terms and say it plainly.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I quite like that. He says something about, like, wizards always talking riddles. He's just speak plainly, which I quite like.
It's when they're talking about the Black Sun. I can't remember specifically what the wizard says, but Geralt just turns around and it's just, it's not true. It doesn't rhyme.
He says all good predictions rhyme.
Oh, yeah.
Which I really like.
Yeah, it's just all good predictions rhyme.
Yeah. and then the wizard, like, rhymes for him, like, later on. And just kind of goes, like, there's your rhyme. Point kind of thing.
Yeah. But it's just the fact, it's like, they're all monsters. It's not true. It doesn't rhyme.
Yeah. This is also, I think, the first scene where we see the wolf medallion clearly.
Yeah.
Because he's wandering around without his cloak on. Mm. Now, I thought it was interesting because they went with the book-style medallion.
Yeah.
Not the one that's in the game.
Yeah.
Because the game one is literally just the wolf's head facing outwards.
Yeah, it's like a spiky wolf's head. To be fair, in the first game, it's not. In the very first game, it's a circular medallion with that wolf's head kind of printed on it. But in the second and third, it's just a wolf's head, and it's like a 3D shaped medallion, which I don't know why they changed it, but yeah, it's similar to the description of the medallion in the book, which is a circular medallion with a snarling wolf's head on it, which I think it's fair to say, like, they're ignoring the games as a form, which is fair enough. The writer didn't consider them canon. Why should the Netflix series? It makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. But I just thought it was interesting that this is the first time we see it, so yeah. We kind of see the hint of the School of the Wolf there anyway. Mm. We then go back to the princess and the queen, so we see them in the ceremony where they're knighting their visitors and things like this.
Yeah.
Now, I cannot remember the actress's name, but the queen is my favourite character in this entire episode.
Queen Calanthe, the lioness of Cintra.
Oh my god.
Good.
She's so cool. And she's played by the same actress. Now, you may not understand this reference. Okay. This is for Jay Knights and other Austin fans. I thought you were getting up to leave. Like, no, not for me.
Not for me.
There's a book called Emma. And in this book, Emma goes around and matchmakes loads of people. And she has a governess that kind of is one of the first people she matchmakes. And she sets up a governess with this other, like, single widower. And it's really romantic. And the governess is basically her moral compass the entire way through the story. And it's played by the same actress as this queen. So the first thing I ever saw this actress in is this really, like, softly spoken, well-dressed, demure lady. And then in this, she's snarky. She's like, will you pay attention? She's powerful. She goes into battle. She's not a queen that's going to sit at home and, like, plot or whatever. She's not a Cersei where she hides behind barracks and, like, things like that. No, she's at the forefront.
Yeah.
Her husband is as snarky as she is. I loved their dynamic. I thought that was really, really cool. Like, I found it really bizarre that they were called their grandmother and grandfather.
It's because they are. So one of the stories that they've kind of skipped is that also contains Calanthe and the grandfather. Is originally they weren't married, but it was essentially the first time Geralt makes a choice in the book, at least. Like, obviously, because the Blaviken story, I think, either comes after. Is essentially he goes. He's requested by Calanthe to kill someone who has come for her daughter. I can't remember the daughter's name. But essentially as part of this ritual that they have, or not a ritual, but like a tradition almost called the Child Surprise, which is when you save someone, instead of asking for a specific reward, you can say, it's like, I will have the first thing that you see that surprises you when you get home. And her original husband agreed to this after being saved by this knight, goes home, and the first thing he is surprised by is a new daughter. So that's the knight's prize, and then it turns out that they've been sleeping together anyway, and Queen Calanthe is furious, and then realises that actually it's not a bad thing. A battle ensues, the King of Skellige, which is another island in the world, and she's like, well, we've been boning too, so maybe we should get married.
Is she just having sex with all these people?
No. Like, the daughter's been having sex with the
knight. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
I was
yeah.
like, all
no,
right.
Queen Calanthe, after her husband died, started relations with Skellige. And no one really knew about it, although everyone really knew about it.
Such is the way with courts.
Yeah. But no one really spoke about it, and then it's the first time he kind of comes out and actively states it, and she kind of likes that, and it's like, you know what, screw it. Yeah, everyone gets married. But at the party, it's kind of revealed that Calanthe and her line are something called the Children of Elder Blood, which is like the blood of elves, and her daughter kind of has this violent magical explosion that happens to the point that everything kind of gets a bit fucked up.
And because we see hints of that in her daughter.
Yeah,
so in the way she screams and, yeah.
But one thing that, and this happens in the book as well, and it never really made sense to me, is they state that Calanthe doesn't have this ability because the blood's ability seems to skip a generation. Which doesn't quite make sense, because then...
then the daughter shouldn't have it.
Yeah, Ciri shouldn't have it either. But yeah, that's why it's grandparents, as they are actually her grandparents.
No, that wasn't the bit that confused me. The bit that confused me is they do not look old enough to be grandparents. And I get that obviously she's meant to be a lot younger than the actress. She's very young in the face.
Yeah, Ciri as a character, when that sort of part of the story happens, is only 6.
Yeah, and obviously she's played by like a 14-year-old. Yeah. So, but even that, like, the difference in age, and they keep calling it, like, they have to, like, say, yes, grandmother and grandfather. And it's almost like, you know when you see, like, those really bad plays, and it's just like, yes, your majesty, they couldn't even afford a crown, so they're like, they're just going to say it a lot of times, so you know that's who they are, kind of thing.
Speaking of her grandfather, I thoroughly enjoyed when it's just, it was... Like, when they're kind of whispering behind Queen Calanthe, she's knighting someone. And it's just, what were you doing in the market? Playing 5-bone pickup. Did you win?
Yeah, and then he's, like, disappointed in her when she doesn't. She's like, no, just, not this time.
It was just, no.
Did you win this time?
Yeah, it was like, did you win this time? And it's just, no, I was spooked by the horses. And it's like, if you can't even win a game of 5-bone pickup when there's horses, how are you going to survive in battle?
Yeah.
And it's just, come on. We know you're doing it. Just be good at it.
Be good at it, yeah. If you're going to sneak out and do it, be good at it. And I really like the dynamic. I also like the fact that he was constantly talking about like his relationship with Calanthe. And she's just like, gross. We could go upstairs, basically. Yeah,
it's like, I am tired from my travels and my exertion this morning.
Yeah.
Gross.
Because he's not a blood relation to her, like, it's not as creepy.
Yeah.
But I just find the dynamic's really interesting.
That grandparent connection as well, like...
Yeah.
You always seem to have a more relaxed relationship with your grandparents than you do with your parents.
Yeah, I think so. Well, because there's the distance. They didn't have to raise you. I mean, they are raising her.
Yeah.
But, you know, they care about her, and that's just... I really, really, really liked that. But, yeah, I thought the actress... that plays the queen, her acting was beautiful. Because then the next scene is obviously they're at the banquet, and she gives some advice to Ciri about first rule of being a queen is always be on the move, or always be moving, or something like that. Always have your sword close.
Keep your sword close to you and keep moving. Yeah.
And you see a visible change in her.
Yeah.
When the herald comes, or the messenger comes in, and all you hear is the word Nilfgaard, and you've already had. Some preamble from the king that the Nilfgaard are on their way, and she's like, no, it's fine, like, they wouldn't come this way, why would they come this way? And then you see on her face the difference, because she at this point realizes exactly what's going to happen.
They've come this way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, great, like, I can't remember what it is, it's like, good chess players think 5 steps ahead. Great chess players only think 1 step ahead, but it's the right move.
Yeah.
And it's, I think at this point she realises she's made the wrong move, or she's made the wrong assumption. She's thought several steps ahead, but they weren't the right steps.
Yeah.
So it's just really powerful acting in a really short scene that actually I just thought needed talking about. I just thought it was great.
I got very little, I don't think I've got anything really negative about the first episode yet.
No. So the next scene is then back to the woods in Renfrew, and this is where we see Geralt talking to his horse, which I thought was great.
Oh, it was so good. Henry Cavill is just...
an excellent choice. I mean, I just think it's beautiful anyway.
Well, this is the thing. Clearly, the character of Geralt is quite attractive because he sleeps with everyone in the books. If you've got a vagina, he sleeps with you.
Huh.
Or at least, you know, he considers
it. No, he's like, maybe.
He never makes the first move. Which is why I say clearly he's attractive.
Yeah.
But sorcerers just throw themselves at him, and he very rarely refuses.
I remember watching you play one of the games, and it came to like one of those cut scenes where it was like a sideway cut sex scene. And I was like, I have chosen the wrong moment to come in and sit and watch you play Xbox.
Yeah.
But,
I'm like,
all right, I'm going to go wash my eyes out.
I'll be back in a bit. Let me know when it's done.
Yeah. So I thought less of a surprise that she was a princess/monster. And then I don't remember the Rick part. That's because at this point I still thought it was the Voice of Reason.
Mm.
Because that's very, very similar. So in the Voice of Reason, the storyline is that Geralt arrives to kill a monster. But she's not really a monster. It's a girl that has been cursed by a witch or a wizard and becomes this monster. And they try to kill her and they send knights after her and she just kills them one after the next.
Well, she's a monster. She was... It was essentially, it was a child born of incest.
Yeah.
That is then stillborn. They put it in a crypt, and then a few days later it arises as a Strigger, which is a type of monster. And then, like, over the next 10 years, she just kills everything that goes after it. Until Geralt arrives and fixes the problem. Yeah. Because that's what he do.
That's what he do. But he doesn't fix it as we expect him to by killing her. He takes the curse away and kind of saves her. So at this point, I still thought it was that storyline.
Yeah.
So I was like, I can't remember her being raped and whatever. So when she talks about that and you're like, oh, that's a different story. This is a different princess monster. This is just a horrible world they live in kind of thing. Which I thought was really interesting. And then it cuts back to the queen and king going out to fight.
Yeah.
Now, you made a comment whilst we were watching it that you liked the difference in armour styles.
Yeah, because obviously, like at least in the game, Skellige is based more on like Scotland and Ireland, that very like, Gaelic armour style, which they kind of showed in the grandfather's armour.
Because he's got all like the Celtic.
Yeah, and it's like and it's like a golden bronze or sort of thing, whereas hers is very simplistic. It's just a sheet of metal.
It's very Arthur on the Round Table, isn't it?
Yeah, and she's got like the lion paws on her shoulders, which I quite liked because obviously she is the lioness of Sintra.
You love saying that, don't you?
It's such a cool title.
She's a cool person.
She's a cool person.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I just the diff, like the notable difference. But it's not just everyone has like a flat breastplate and that's it.
Mm.
Like they've got actual difference, and in the Nilfgaardian armor as well.
Yeah,
like it is black armor, but it's got like intricate details on it that look quite cool.
It's very reminiscent of the Night Watch from Game of Thrones armor in the way that it's black with like the puckered, like spike bits on it, which I thought was really interesting. It makes them look more menacing.
Yeah.
Whereas, and it does, it separates, again, using that monochrome separation of here are the good guys, here are the bad guys kind of thing. What I thought was really, really interesting, when they come over the hill and they see the other army, the camera pans across and zooms in on the king and queen's faces.
Mm.
And I've specifically put here that there is a very different expression on their faces that actually foreshadows how they end.
Mm.
So she looks terrified. Again, because she's thinking steps ahead.
Yeah.
The king looks peaceful. There's almost no expression on his face whatsoever.
Mm.
And what I loved is the fact that that pretty much emulates how they go. Because, unfortunately, they both die. Not here in this moment necessarily, but the king is shot with an arrow through the eye and that's it. And she gives an order. He basically says, yeah, we'll follow that through. And then immediately dies. And it's quick, he falls to the floor, there's no dramatics. I think they slow it down a little bit.
I don't even know if they do that. I think they slow down her reaction.
Yeah.
Him getting shot and him falling.
It's really human, isn't it? Yeah. And so I thought it was really interesting that actually, of all the ways to go, that was relatively peaceful.
Mm.
Like, he's dead. That's it, it's over.
He was dead, like, before he hits the ground.
Yeah. Right? Whereas, obviously, she pushes her way through to try to get to the guy who shot the arrow.
Mm.
That obviously doesn't get there because the next time we see her, she is dying in her own castle. So I thought it was quite interesting that, that quick pan, this is how they're going to die.
Yeah.
Like, this is the day that they die kind of thing. It then cuts back to Geralt and his horse again. And he says something quite interesting, which is, I don't pick sides.
Mm.
Now, you said, what was the name of the title this is based on? The Lesser Evil?
Lesser Evil, yeah.
Yeah, so we've already heard at this point the wizard say, you know, you have to choose the Lesser Evil. And then the woman who's trying to kill the wizard says basically the same thing.
Yeah.
So these two people are trying to kill themselves, and Geralt is stuck in the middle, and they both want him to choose a side. And he says, I don't pick sides.
Yeah.
Now, this was, for me, a real issue in the story. It's not going to be an issue going forwards because I know it's the first episode and I can see why the writers did this. But one of the key elements to, and I cannot remember if it was John Truby or someone else, in one of the books that's about writing, they talk about the lie your character believes at the start of a story. And the idea being that each act is when that lie is challenged and they believe a new lie, or they're forced to see the truth, kind of thing. So you can see different elements of the story. So for example, Robin Hood, we'll go for an absolute classic that everyone understands. Robin Hood comes back from war and believes that his world will be as he left it. He then realises this is a lie and his world has changed. He then believes the lie that he can fix it by following the law. This again proves to be a lie and he has to change. He then becomes an outlaw and thinks that he can save the world that way. Because that's the truth, is he cannot use the law in the same way that the Sheriff of Nottingham is using the law, because it's the scales aren't even. So he makes mistakes along the way, but fundamentally he realises that what he believes is a lie and he moves on from that. Now, the I don't pick sides thing, or I shouldn't have to choose element, is the lie that Geralt believes, is that he can live this fine line in the morally grey and not pick a side. And what annoyed me then about the rest of this story is he then picks a side, which is not a problem, but he's punished for it. So rather than that being the lie that he believes, that then the truth is revealed and he has to kind of overcome that, which is how most stories progress. He believes something, he then goes against his own beliefs and then is punished for that, which is a very Shakespearean thing to do, but it is not modern storytelling.
I wouldn't necessarily say that he did pick a side though.
No, but he does, because the wizard says, you picked a side, because, you know, and even the Renfrey says, you picked a side, because he turns up to the town by doing that. If he had let them fight each other and kill each other or whatever, he was picking a side and fighting her rather than going to the tower where the wizard was. He picked a side. He wanted to stop her. That was the choice he made. I think
the reason he stopped her is she was going to kill innocents to get to the wizard. Like, if it were the other way round and the wizard was hurting people, he would stop the wizard.
No, but that's what I'm saying. But he has already had the conversation with the wizard that the wizard has killed innocents by one, sending them after him, and two, by killing these 60 girls that he was convinced. And so he's already had a go at him for doing that.
Yeah.
So at this point, they are even. They are still even. And he makes his choice. When he kills Renfrey, he's tipped the scales. They're no longer even because one of them's alive and one of them's dead. If they'd killed each other, then yeah, fine. But it's at this point, so that's not how I would have written it, because that's not how his story should progress. He should still believe his lie that I'm not going to pick sides. And this is how I would have written it. So this is kind of like how I would fix this problem. Is instead of him making a choice and going after her and deciding this is what I'm going to do, is I'm going to fight her and stop her from killing anyone else, is I would have had him ride out of town. And then as he's riding out of town, see the city burning or whatever. And coming back and seeing that by not making a choice, everyone's dead. So the wizard has set things on fire, Renfrey's killed loads of people, and neither of them are there. So everyone else has died, but they've both managed to escape for whatever reason. Because by him not acting, then it's the innocents.
Yeah.
Now, the milk girl, the alderman's daughter, has a really distinct necklace. All it would have taken was for Geralt to go back to the town, find it, like, bloodied or what have you, and find this necklace for him to then make a choice and actually decide, no, they are both as bad as each other. There is no lesser evil. They both need to go. Now, that's him kind of making a choice, but still believing his lie. So he can then move forwards, slowly changing, because he's making choices even if he doesn't see that. And he's had the lie revealed to him because he does need to make a choice. Now, I do think it's interesting that, you know, he then becomes the butcher because he kills Renfrey and her men, and then the wizard turns them against him very, very quickly to protect himself.
Yeah, saying about the choices. In that case, like, he has made a choice and is then punished for it. I think that almost kind of lends itself to the idea of why he no longer makes choices. Like, he doesn't choose because it doesn't matter what he chooses. People are going to get hate him for it. If he doesn't choose, they don't hate him for it.
But he has already learned that lesson.
Yeah, no, it's more just, it's showing, it's like, he's not, he's still fallible. Like,
yeah.
He still makes the same mistakes he was making at the very beginning. Because that's the story that he tells his horse about. His first monster was the big, muscular, bald man with rotting teeth. But in the description, sounds like a monster until... until it's revealed that he's a man, like, gives a witty quip, and then saves the girl, covers her in, she gets covered in the guy's blood. But it's not until she looks at him that she screams and then vomits.
Yeah, passes out.
And passes out. And it's kind of, it's literally, it's just, it's that again, is he saved everyone.
And they still turn on
him. One thing I did find quite amusing is during his fight with, I think it's with Renfrey, you can see in the background there's a few villagers just blurred out, like, because of the focus, just kind of standing there watching, which I find really amusing. But one thing you do see is he makes, like, a movement with his hand to attempt to try and, like, manipulate her with magic.
Mm.
And later on, you see the wizard's hand opening from that same position. And then everyone starts being really angry with Geralt. It's almost as if, like, just subtly they're stating it's the wizard has manipulated him into hating him.
Yeah, and it is. It's on a dime because everyone's just kind of stood around watching and not really involved. And I think the cruelest bit is then the alderman's daughter comes in and basically says, you need to leave.
Yeah.
And considering how excited she was when he arrived, you can see... And what's really interesting is, like, yeah, he could have slaughtered them all for that.
Mm.
And he doesn't, because there's no need. It would be excessive and they're innocent. Yeah, and he understands their manipulation. And fundamentally, if he goes to attack the wizards, they will turn on him even more. And the wizard is just using them as, like, human shields, basically. Which I did think was really interesting. But, like I said, I think my frustration is that's not character growth.
Mm.
Because if he is just still making that same mistake... We don't need to hear him tell that story and then have the same outcome. Surely it should have been that he tells that story and then he learns a new mistake because actually he doesn't make that choice and it's a worse outcome.
Mm.
And then you have the lesser evil. It's a case of, yeah, they fucking hate me, but one less monster, two less monsters. They will live the rest of their lives now being able to survive, like... Yeah, they can hate me. That's not what I'm not here to be loved.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is he does care. One of the first things the wizard says is, of course, the thing about your kind is they feel nothing.
Mm.
And you can see he's annoyed by that. He's like, yeah, I do feel. I feel anger. I feel love. Like, and he feels these things.
Yeah.
He might not necessarily express them on his face. He cares when that town turns against him.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, really interesting.
One thing I did like is that, they start, like, throwing stones at him and he kind of just protects his face. Kneels down, picks up the brooch. That Renfrey had and takes that with him and just leaves.
Yeah.
And that, I think, will serve as a reminder later on that he should make choices and kind of live with that. And I think it's the first episode. There shouldn't be that much character growth, I think, in the first episode.
I'm not saying necessarily that... the first episode should set up what the story is going to be about. And if the story is going to be about him making choices... then the first choice he should make is not making a choice. Because that is his background. And that is why the story needs to happen.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this is the first domino. But if the first domino is actually him making a choice and making the wrong choice, that feels far further along in his character arc, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's why for me, the way it happened that way around, it didn't work for me. I didn't dislike the episode, and I'm definitely going to watch the rest, obviously, because we want to do this podcast anyway. But also, I just think, if I was the editor of this, that is not how I'd have, like, forced it to go. Like, if I was the writer of this, that's not the direction I'd have taken this in. Because I think we already understand, by this point, that everyone wants him to make a choice. So the subversion would be for him to not make a choice, and it would feel more authentic than him making a choice and then everyone hating him for the choice that he makes. Now, I do appreciate that people are manipulated to dislike him for that choice. And the worst part of it is, you know, the wizard says right when he first meets him that he is hiding there and she has tracked him there, but he's taken the position of someone else that everyone thinks lives there. He doesn't, he's just hiding. He doesn't have any attachment to these people whatsoever. He is just a wizard in hiding. And the fact that he was so ready to manipulate these people, he feels like a god. And it will be really frustrating if that guy never gets any kind of comeuppance in this series. But it, and as Geralt leaves, that was really unsatisfying. And I've got a really bad feeling that they're never going to come back to this.
Well, if they go by the books, I don't think they... At least they haven't so far.
Yeah. So that was the bit kind of...
I think it's like the saying about like what the kind of motif of the whole thing is going to be. I think it's less going to be about him making choices and more about him accepting his destiny, because a lot of the characters stated the word destiny.
Yeah.
And mainly when they were talking about Ciri, it was destiny for her to become queen. And they kept saying, like, the child in the woods will be your destiny.
The girl in your
the girl, woods. The girl, yeah.
That was really weird, because I didn't know if that was a premonition or if that was her talking to him whilst he was passed out. But then she says it again. So Renfri says, like, the girl in the woods will be your destiny.
Yeah.
And that really threw me. Not when he was in the woods, because he woke up and she was gone. And I was like, oh, it's a premonition. It's something like that. And then when she says it in real life, I was like, why? Why is she giving him...
I think it was, it may have been a premonition in the woods. I think when she says it in real life, that's more of a remember me nicely.
Mm.
Like, have fond memories of me. That time that we had sex in the woods, that's what I want you to remember, not cutting my throat.
Also, we were promised sex and nudity, and all he does is stick his face in her boobs. That's all we see, boob face.
Yeah. And then, but there is also the wizard tower of
just naked,
like,
ladies.
Just steps through an illusionary door and just, oh, cool, there's like three naked ladies. I genuinely had to double take at that point.
Yeah. Oh. I was like, I wasn't really surprised. When we came around, it's like, oh, they're all just like pruning their bushes and stuff. I was like, of course they fucking are. And he's just like, oh, it's nice to pass the time and stuff. It's he's fucking creep.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's a creepy old man. I did quite like actually saying about that, not the naked ladies, but the palette shift for colours. Like, what, like, it's the whole thing is very grey, and then when he steps into the wizard's tower, it's very vibrant colours.
Like, they're soft pastels and corals and stuff like that. Yeah,
but there's actual.
It feels like summer, as opposed to the winter that's outside.
Yeah, that's which fun. I quite liked. So I suppose lastly we'll talk about the last scene with Ciri, where Syntra gets overthrown.
So
by Nilfgaard.
Nilfgaard. Who are the Nilfgaards? Can you just explain that?
So,
like, they were just kind of like this black, evil presence.
Yeah, so they are an evil empire from another part of the world, ruled by Emir von Everett, who in the games perfectly is voiced by Charles Dance.
Amazing.
Like, you don't get a better voice for a cold, calculating emperor than
there's a reason he's the head of the Lannister family.
Yeah. I was going to call him Charles Darwin, and that's a completely Charles different Darwin. Man.
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's just this conquering empire
that's
just slowly taking over the whole world. And in the Blood of Elves, it's kind of, they're talking about the fall of Syntra and the Battle of Sodden Hill and stuff like that. Actually, one thing that they didn't have is, I think in that one, they've kind of, like, because they haven't set up many of the sorceresses yet, but in the books, the Battle of Sodden Hill, one of the main sorceresses, Triss, is there, and it's believed that she dies, and that becomes a plot point later, but she was obviously there in this one, which is interesting. I'll be interested to see why they...
Like, why where she pops up.
But yeah, it's kind of the attack on Syntra is the start of the Blood of Elves, and obviously it's the end of this one.
That's really cool. So the queen is obviously returned to the castle.
Yeah.
And Ciri asks her if she's dying. And she comes out with the boss line that was like, no, when I die, it will be much more dramatic.
Yeah.
And I fucking loved that. Like,
yeah, 10 out of 10.
I have a new queen. Just FYI. Like, and I love her.
It was just... And it's a great way to, one... remain, like, in character for her. Like, she is this strong, stoic, badass woman. But also to reassure her granddaughter, like, without sacrificing her by being like, no, it's fine. I'll be
fine. I'll be okay. Like, she knows she's dying. Yeah. She knows she's going to be okay. But
she also knows that her death will be far more dramatic whether she dies now or if she gets better and continues to live.
Absolutely.
But I just fucking, it's like, it'll be much more dramatic.
I just thought that was so perfect.
And it is. It is really dramatic.
Well, it is. It's quite interesting. So, obviously, the castles are then attacked by the Nilfgaard, and she talks Ciri through each element of what's happening. She's like, at the moment, half people are being slaughtered.
Yeah.
They're having their tongues cut out and fed to dogs. They're having their legs set on fire. They're having their
insides brought outside. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's not sugarcoating it.
Yeah, no, not at all.
People are dying. They are dying brutally. They do not keep prisoners. Yeah. And then she sends her granddaughter away. What I thought was really, like, the bit that fucking got me was Ciri's holding her hand and says, "I love you." And she just goes, "Find Geralt." Like, she can't bring herself to be weak in front of other people. You can see she wants to say it. And again, like, she has, like, the single tear going down. Her face is still muddy and bloody from the battle. Like, it's so beautifully done. And then you see her, like, whilst Ciri is trying to escape, you see her struggling to stand.
Yeah.
And struggling to walk. And throwing the windows open and enjoying the fresh air on her face. And then you see her fall. And it's staggered between watching the battle and watching Ciri escape. And also watching Geralt fight the Renfri's men. So it's all cut between. And what I thought was really, really interesting of that is the fact that, yeah, it is more dramatic, but it's a real slow burn.
Yeah.
She's only in one episode, and yet she is one of the most powerful characters in that episode, and she kind of controls the entire narrative of the battle with Nilfgaard. And, you know, when Ciri screams and things start to shake, and the sorcerer that works for them basically says, she's like, "Yeah, I saw it."
Yeah.
She's like, "And that's why they've come for her." Like, she knows. She's playing the right game. And what I thought was really interesting is she then turns to her bodyguard and says, "It's time." And he goes around and hands poison to all the different royals. And you see them, choosing their poison. What I thought was really interesting about that, he has 3 poison bottles in his hand for the person that the family that Ciri is betrothed to.
Yeah.
Or at least it's implied that she's, like, their betrothed part of the way. The guy she's made to dance with. I thought it was really interesting because the father only takes 2.
Yeah.
So, and the guy looks at him like, "You're missing one." Like, and he just takes 2. And then he turns to his wife and says, like, "It's time." She's like, "We can escape." And he's like, "No, this is our escape."
Yeah.
He then gets her to feed a poison to their son, who's barely awake and just kind of like, which I thought, again, was really interesting because, again, if you think Ciri's meant to be 6 and this boy is meant to be her equal, he, like, even though he's depicted by a 14-year-old boy, he's obviously meant to be quite young. That was heartbreaking.
Mm.
Then you see the wife being fed the poison by the husband. And she just looks so serene and so peaceful as she's drinking it. And then, because there's no poison left, he stabs himself in the neck with a knife by holding it there and then just smacking his hand against it.
Yeah.
And it's such a brutal way to go, but you don't see it. You see it from behind him. He sat in a chair. He sat at his banquet table. And what I find really fascinating about that is it's his last moment of control.
Yeah.
He's not going down without a fight. He knows that he's not a soldier, so he can't be out there fighting. He knows that by the time they find him, they are going to brutally destroy him, but he refused to poison himself.
Yeah.
And I just found that as a dynamic, considering he has barely any dialogue and his scene is less than a minute long. That was really interesting. And I think if we get more of those little clips, the world is going to feel really fleshed out, even if we only spend time with Geralt and Ciri. Because obviously the opening episode, it's 2 separate people in 2 separate states that are then having to find each other later and kind of work together. So understanding that their worlds are more fleshed out than just they are, I thought was actually really great storytelling. So that little scene, which could be completely inconsequential to someone else, from a writer's perspective, was really fucking important. And I just thought that was really cool as, like, a last-ditch attempt at control.
Yeah. Yeah, because, like, when I was watching it to begin with, I was like, why? Like, I figured he'd only taken the 2 because, like, there was only 2 of them. I'd forgotten about the son. And then to see him like stab himself in the throat that way, it didn't really make sense. It's like, why would you not take the peaceful poison over stabbing yourself in the throat?
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know, because I can't remember. They don't actually say it in the books like where they're from. I don't think they state it in the show either.
Just that they're from another kingdom.
Yeah. And that's one that they're just going to try and like join borders with. But yeah, I thought that was, like I said, I thought it was interesting, but I didn't fully understand it.
Yeah.
I did quite like, as Ciri's leaving the building, or the castle, the same Nilfgaardian archer, you'd assume, the one that kills
Her
grandfather, kills her bodyguard, picks her up, takes her out of the city, and the same thing that happens in that was in the castle, which like, she screams, and things kind of start shaking, massive... like crystal pillar.
It's like obsidian or something like that, isn't it?
Like falls and cracks and
like completely destroys the floor.
Yeah, and it just splits to the point that she's on one side, the Nilfgaardian's on the other, and there's no way he's getting to her, and she runs away.
Yeah, he just gets really angry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting because he, as an antagonist, he is just a black shape.
Yeah.
And the moment you see him coming around the corner on the horse, and they're riding away obviously by this point anyway, and you get like this little car chase scene where it's two horses, that was really interesting because, again, he's someone that doesn't have any dialogue, but just his shape and his presence has already been set up, and then this is the payoff, is we know she's in danger because it's this person, not someone else.
Yeah.
And if the sorcerer had been with her, she might have stood a chance. But the sorcerer has already had to succumb to other, you know, attacks because there were other people. And he was like, well, the soldier will protect you kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the soldier won't answer her questions, which she rightly has, because we don't need to know this yet.
Yeah.
Like, and it wouldn't make sense for him to be like, oh, yeah, wait, here's your entire heritage. Like, there's no time. His priority is getting her out of the city. And then, of course they ride out and she screams when she sees her tower burn. And then she screams again and the obsidian falls, which is great. And then she runs and hides into the woods. And that's when we hear that line again, that the girl in the woods
is your destiny.
Which I think is really interesting because it kind of just, now we know. Now we know what's going to happen, sort of. They're going
to know that they're destined to, like, to come together,
And
that was kind of the end of the episode.
Yeah. So a lot going on.
Yeah.
I did enjoy it. I know it doesn't sound like I enjoyed it. But the issue I have, and I was trying to explain this to someone the other day, because we were talking about the books that I read once I'd finished my master's, and I said, reading is really fucking hard after you've done a degree that's essentially reading and writing, because you cannot watch anything or read anything or go into anything without being critical, because it's so tied to all those skills you've learned about being critical, that you watch something or you read something like this, and it's really hard to switch that off. And like, I remember when I read the first short story in The Last Wish, I counted how many adjectives were on the first page, and I counted how many adverbs.
Yeah.
It was 13 and 27, and that's a crazy amount. If you think that there's only like 200 words per page, that 10% of that is an adverb is crazy. And it's like, it's things like that then actually listening to it as an audiobook made it a lot easier. And then watching it as a TV series, I feel like I fell into the world quite easy. It was very easy for me to be like, right, pause, make a note, kind of thing like that, just because that's the kind of human being that I am. But I did really, really enjoy it. And I think anyone else that enjoys fantasy will really enjoy this series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%.
And then hopefully it will actually get a wider audience, kind of like Game of Thrones did, where it just kind of sucked in the mainstream as well. Because it was good. It was good storytelling. I had my issue with his lie thing, but as acts go, it made sense. I can't remember how to describe the role. Essentially, it's every time the character makes the decision they cannot go back from, the act changes. So there did feel like there was a three-act structure, because each time the character is making a decision or learning something about themselves or the world they live in, they cannot return. Ciri cannot return to her kingdom. It is burnt to the ground. She cannot rely on her grandmother. Her grandmother is dead. She cannot, like, there's all these different things. Geralt cannot avoid making choices forever. So it was all these different things that I thought were really, really interesting components. And I don't know. I mean, How do you think it compared to like playing the games or reading the books?
I think it worked out quite well. Like it's definitely better as a visual medium, I think. Like just because you get that feeling of the world. Like, yeah, they can describe it in the books, and that's great. And the descriptions are quite in-depth. Like you said, there are 13 adjectives and 37 adverbs.
27,
yeah. There's a lot of descriptive language in the books. But I think just because of the colour shift and all the things that they want to do, and it is an action-centric story,
yeah,
it makes better sense to be in a visual medium.
Yeah.
And the games do that very well. The show does that like amazing. One thing actually is the combat itself. It's so very fast-paced. It was something I said whilst we were watching it, is the like things in like Game of Thrones, like it's a lot slower paced, the combat, like you'll see them almost consider every sword swing or whatever. But because Geralt is a mutant and he is faster, like his thoughts are faster, he is stronger, he is more dexterous, they can't allow that same sort of time to think about his moves. It's just cool. This, done. Mm-hmm. Now you're dead.
Yeah. And it is beautifully choreographed.
Oh, yeah.
It moves 100%. So well. And I like the fact that it isn't 100 different cuts either.
Yeah.
Like, there are cuts, but there's not a shaky cam or whatever CinemaSins says. But I like the fact that it was a dance.
Yeah.
And it's steps that he knows.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. I thought it was really clever.
Well, that's the point, is he was, like, all witches are trained in fencing, which is essentially, like, pirouettes and things like that in terms of dance. Which it does make sense that his movements would be fluid. Mm. But yeah, saying about like the fact he's quicker as well, back to the very, very beginning with the monster, is you were saying like he used its strength and everything against it. He just, on a dime, is like, cool, I've got my footing, now my sword's in its face.
Yeah.
Like, and that was it, fight over. And they kind of do a similar thing later, when it's the battle with Renfri, is that he's taken her sword from her, and all she's got is her stiletto dagger. And, like, she goes to use it against him.
And you just use it against her.
Well, yeah, like, before you can blink, like, the dagger's against her own throat, like, in her neck. And then he just shifts a little bit and it pops out and her throat slit.
Yeah.
Like, before you can blink, it's over.
Yeah, well, the thing is, she's the one that keeps pressing. And what I find really interesting is he responds wound for wound. So every time she slashes him, he slashes her.
Yeah.
But it's never a kill shot until she goes to kill him.
Mm.
And that's when he just twists her arm and, like you said, slices her throat open. But it's her hands. If she let go or anything like that, if she had, like, surrendered, if she'd surrendered, that would have been an issue.
Yeah.
But she'd said to him right from the start, once she starts, she will not be able to stop. And she'd already started.
Yeah.
She'd already tried to kill people. And she'd already hurt people and stuff like that. So, it was really, really interesting. What do you think is going to happen next?
I hope... they don't have Ciri and Geralt meet up right away. I feel like as much as that is going to be like the main crux of the story, I think they should have at least one more episode without it. Mm. Just to kind of, because they talk about the fact that Ciri was alone for like 6 months, I think, before Geralt finds her. And she kind of learned to survive on her own outside of a castle. Like she got jobs working on farms and like things like being able to feed herself and stuff like that before he then turned up, took her to the Witcher Castle and trained her. Which was another thing, actually, coming back to Maralka, was that she was like, girls can't be witches, can they? Because that's just stupid. And it's like that foreshadows Ciri becoming a witcher, which is something that does happen in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert.
It happens in the games as well, doesn't it?
By the third game, I don't know if she appears in the first, so I can't really remember. By the third game, she's like a grown adult. She's out in the world being a witcher. Although she doesn't get the silver sword for some reason, which is kind of dumb, but whatever.
Each to their own.
So I hope it's going to be that. I think we need to properly meet Nilfgaard.
Hmm.
I don't know if they're going to do that right away.
I imagine they would, but that's kind of my prediction. The next episode is going to be about Nilfgaard trying to find her. And it will be, I think we'll finally get to see who the lead antagonists are going to be, because other than, you know, the black soldier,
yeah,
we didn't really see anything of that. Yeah. But I know that the trailer is very heavily about a lady, queen or whatever, that's kind of evil looking and stuff like that. So it could have something to do with her as the antagonist.
Yeah.
Which would be quite interesting.
Yeah, it'd be quite interesting to meet like other main characters as well. So like Trist and Yennefer and the two sorceresses in his life. Would be quite interesting. But just more world building, I reckon.
Hmm.
They're going to kind of expand it, make it feel like a world. Maybe show Geralt out on the trail hunting a new monster or whatever.
Yeah.
But kind of, yeah, I think the next episode is just going to be a bit more world building, setting things up for later.
Yeah. How many episodes are in this season? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay. That'll be interesting. Okay. We'll check that out. And then, yeah. Well, we hope you enjoyed listening to us talking about
Pratlon.
Yeah, all of it, talking about all of it.
Yeah.
And are we posting these weekly or bi-weekly? What's the plan with us?
Probably weekly.
Probably weekly.
If we can.
I mean, we'll watch them quicker than that.
Oh, yeah.
That's who we are as human beings.
Like, basically right away, let's be honest.
But yeah, these videos will come out weekly. So we hope you've enjoyed them. Definitely put down your predictions.
Oh my God. That's... I put it on Do Not Disturb, but whatever.
Whatever.
Try that one again.
I think I'm just going to say, okay, thank you for watching. This has been The School of the Wolf. I've learnt a lot. I hope you have too. We're going to go watch the second episode now because I don't think we can wait for another one.
No, not at all.
No.
But yeah. So, cool.